Hey peeps, welcome back to the Decolonized Christian Podcast, where we dismantle harmful theology and reimagine the Christian witness together. I'm here today with my friend Aaron Green. I met Aaron on Twitter. We've been following each other for a while. And I invited Aaron on today because she wrote a devotional on a Bible app that I use. And the devotional really, really, really resonated with me. I remember reading it. I was at church while I was reading it. I was sitting in the choir, probably kind of bored at that time. And I just pulled out my phone and started reading the devotional. And it really, really just spoke to me. And so I'm going to allow Aaron to introduce herself to you all, and then we will get into the questions that I have today. So Aaron, if you could let our audience know a bit more about you.
Sure. Thanks, Greg. Thanks for having me on. I'm excited. I know it's been a few back and forths with us to get this to happen, but I'm so excited that it's finally taking place today. My name's Aaron Green. My pronouns are she, they. I am a campus organizer for an organization called REAP, which stands for Religious Exemption Accountability Project. We, in essence, protect queer, trans, and non-binary students who attend religious colleges across the country. Very important work that I'm excited to be a part of. I have a religious background, grew up in the evangelical church, got my bachelor's degree in biblical studies, led a queer underground movement while I was in undergrad, and then went to seminary and graduated with my MDiv, and then started working as an activist, basically. So that is who I am, or a little snapshot of who I am and what I do.
All right. What seminary did you attend?
What seminary?
Yeah.
I went to San Francisco Theological Seminary.
Okay. So is that where you grew up in the area too?
No, I grew up in Los Angeles, actually, from LA, and, went to high school, college, and all the things down there, and then went to grad school in the Bay.
Gotcha. Well, I just want to commend you on that work that you just told us about, because it's very important work, protecting marginalized people in society in a time where we are constantly under attack through different laws and bills and all types of things. So thank you for that work.
Of course. Yes, it's a cause, I mean, a movement near and dear to my heart as a queer person, you know, who went to a Christian college, who grew up in a religious environment, who was non-affirmed for most of my life. It's so important that people like us are out there championing our communities, and just so they know that there's like a beacon of hope, you know, there's a place they can go for safety and protection. Yeah.
Yes. We need that message in our world today. So thank you again, Aaron. I'm going to dive into the first question that I have for you, and it's about our feelings. The itself is called Our Feelings Are Holy. And so I wanted to ask you why are our feelings holy? And on that first day, I remember day one of the devotional, you talk about how our feelings are often demonized. So why do you think our feelings are holy? And in contrast, why do you feel that they're often demonized? And what about ourselves?
It's a great question. And it's funny when, you know, I had to go through this devotional before we talked, because I had realized that it had been so long since I've written it and cracked it open. You know what I mean? And I'm like making sure I know what the heck I'm talking about. But I'm like, oh, yeah, this makes sense. This is actually really good stuff. Our feelings are demonized, especially in the white evangelical church, I think, as a means to control our bodies, to control our thoughts, to control you know, authority, basically, who has authority in the room.
Right.
Usually it's not women. Usually it's not BIPOC communities. Usually it's not queer, trans, or non-binary folks. It is white men in power. They're the ones who dictate what is happening, you know? So oftentimes our stories get demonized in these spaces. And it's like, no, you can't trust yourself. You can't, you know, oh, you're a queer person. You can't trust your feelings. Because that is going against God. That's going against the text. And they use a verse that they have the verses to kind of back it up. They'll say, well, trust in the Lord with all your heart, lean not on your own understanding. It's so clear. Well, in context, it's not. In that's taking one tiny little verse out of the text and making it dictate the whole of your life's narrative, your feelings, your emotions, your experiences, all those things. And that is not what that particular text is meant to do at all. Because if we look at other portions of the text, if we look at, like, let's look at Job, for instance. Job is an emotional guy, and rightly so. Mm-hmm. He's going through it, you know? And he is using his emotions and his feelings to cry out to God and saying, this is not right. What you have done to me is not right. Right. And I'm willing to take you, he's using court language in the text. He's basically saying, I'm willing to take you to court, God, and prove that I am right. So this emotional outpouring receives a response from God. Job has an encounter directly with God, and God restores everything to Job. Well, we could, that's another podcast, the way that those things are restored. But God responds to the emotion and basically says, you know what, Job, you're actually right in a lot of senses, but you just don't understand certain things. So, but yes, feelings and emotions get demonized, especially among certain communities in the church. And that is what I was trying to hone in on in this particular devotional, is saying to those particular communities, queer, BIPOC, you know, folks, women, especially, no. You are actually championed in the text. Jesus goes to the woman at the well, for instance, and has a conversation with her, asks her to go back to her community, to repeat, to tell, you know, the recount the story.
Right.
So it's, you know, things like that. Jesus goes to marginalized people, discarded people, gives them authority to tell their stories. And those are things that are often overlooked, I think. So that's why I spoke about that in the devotional.
Yeah. And it also makes me think about a phrase you used in the devotional, the sin management.
Yes. This
idea that we simply cannot trust ourselves. Because if we lean into trusting ourselves, then that'll lead us down the path to sin. And I remember being in a conversation with a friend of mine who's very evangelical, white, conservative guy. But, you know, I feel like he sees me in a way. So we get along with each other very well.
Yeah.
He asked me what I thought about the idea of being controlled. Because I was telling him that I don't like being controlled. Like, I don't want people to try to control me. And then he asked me, how does that correlate to my relationship with God? And then I posed the question, well, does God want to control us?
Mm.
You know, there's a nuance there that we have to be willing to explore when it comes to our emotions and our feelings. And a lot of times, I think we have to just accept the fact that there are a lot of things that we were taught to believe there were an issue, but they're really not. They're really not. It's just the fact that this is what someone wanted us to believe for whatever the reason was. And so as I begin to grow my own relationship with God, I've discovered that there are a lot of things that I had to relearn or unlearn is a better word.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of things that I was taught because I realized how it was making me see other people around me and even myself as well. So I just want to share that brief nugget because I think it definitely relates to us not being able to trust ourselves when we talk about sin management. You also mentioned in the devotional, there's a verse, and this is in the Gospels, and we'll get there, but like you mentioned about how Jesus says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, love your neighbor as yourself. But then in Jeremiah, there's a verse that is often quoted about the heart being wicked and deceitful, and who can know? So how is it that, how can we use this heart of ours to love God if it's so wickedly desperate and deceitful?
It's a great question. It's a point where there might be a contradiction there, right? First, I have to say though, let's talk about what Jesus says first. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and Jesus adds mind to it. Because in the Hebrew Bible, the heart and the mind are never separated. They're always one unit. But in Greek thinking and Hellenistic thinking in antiquity, when the Gospels were written and Jesus is talking, that idea is separated, that the heart and the mind are very separate things. So I think that's why Jesus adds the word mind and basically tells us, you know, commands us to love God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love our neighbor as ourselves. I don't think that God would ask us to do that if he didn't expect us to actually utilize our will in our mind and our hearts to love. So if it's funny, I think I mentioned this in the devotional as well. It's kind of ironic. It's weird that Jeremiah would say the heart is deceitful above all things and beyond cure. But Jesus is actually saying, well, it's actually the vessel that you use to love. Mm-hmm. It's the vessel that you use to take action and to action out justice. So how can it be both of those things at the same time?
Right.
Is it wicked or is it good? You know, I think what Jeremiah is saying, because Jeremiah in the text is coming down hard on the folks that he's speaking to as a prophet. He's reminding them that the heart is in the Hebrew, the Hebrew word means crooked. It doesn't mean wicked. It literally means crooked. It just means that it's weak. It's susceptible. So I think what Jeremiah is saying that it's a susceptible vessel and you have to guard it. You have to be careful. Otherwise, it can lead you astray. And y'all have gone astray this time. You know, that's what Jeremiah is doing. He's offering a correction. What Jesus is saying is maybe with that information aside, like we have this weak, susceptible vessel or whatever, but it's also able to do good and to action out love and to do good things. So we can't just, it's not that black and white. It's not binary.
Right.
You know, like a lot of, I would point back again to white evangelical Christians saying, oh no, you can't trust your judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus is actually saying, yes, you can.
Yeah.
Because I'm asking you to do everything with your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And Jesus wouldn't ask us to do that if Jesus didn't trust us to do that.
Right. And another passage comes to mind. It's in Proverbs, where the author of Proverbs commends us to guard our heart because from it is the wellspring of life. As a child, that was a verse that I always held dear to my heart because it made me think about my relationships with other people and how I showed up in community with other people. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a good segue into the next question, which is the Bible itself being used to reflect the emotions and the feelings of the authors of this sacred text. And how does the Bible itself reflect those feelings as being holy? In the devotional, you I think it was day one where you wrote from it. I love Ecclesiastes. It's not a book that is that I hear preached from very often, but I really, really enjoy Ecclesiastes. So just kind of talk to us about how the Bible and its authors reflect their emotions as being holy.
Well, these authors, it's what I love about the text is that we are talking about a range of authors over a huge span of time. These authors have gone through turmoil. They've gone through oppression, or their ancestors have gone through oppression, the Israelites or other communities, things like that. And they're writing from their feelings and their emotions. One of the best places to look for that is in the wisdom literature in the Hebrew Bible, like you mentioned, in Ecclesiastes, Proverbs, Psalms. Huge. If you want to see emotion written down on paper, all you have to do is open up the Book of Psalms. It's filled with nothing but emotion, every single range of emotion that could possibly be felt in the human body, I believe is very apparent in Psalms. When the authors of the gospel texts and beyond are writing about Jesus, they capture a lot of Jesus's raw emotions. They capture his anxiety in the garden before his crucifixion. They capture the fact that Jesus is he's basically having a panic attack and sweating blood.
Right.
So these features, not only from the authors themselves, but the fact that they're capturing these things is very significant to us because it gives us permission to feel, to emote, to be angry, to be happy, to have joy, to live into all of those things, because it is how God designed us.
Right.
So it's actually saying back to God, like, kind of a thank you. You know, like when we cry, when we yell, when we scream, when we laugh, all those things, because that's how God designed us. And I think that is captured all throughout the biblical text.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think something else that comes to mind, specifically just in the person of Jesus, specifically in the Gospels, where we see Jesus exhibiting a range of emotions. And I think that just gives us the right to be fully human. You know, a lot of times I feel like our humanity even is demonized. I have a friend who's a pastor. He pastors a church in St. Louis. And he oftentimes says, if you want to be more holy, be more human.
And I love that. That's great.
It is. And because it resonates so deeply, because I feel like a lot of times we're told that we have to kill our flesh, you know, deny the flesh. Mm-hmm. And I think that if we can learn to navigate this both and, embracing the fact that we are human and we have emotions and feelings, and learning how to be in community with other people and work through those, I think that that is a truer depiction of what it looks like to be Christ-like.
I agree with that. I definitely think that, or I've learned too, like you said, like trying to harness emotions, real raw emotion, does not do anything for our anxiety, our depression, our mental health, you know, and being restricted in those emotions actually, I believe, harms us, you know. And I want to mention, as you bring that up, there are specific communities who are not allowed to express their emotions in certain ways. And we know that it's Black communities, queer, trans, non-binary people, women. Yep. Again, going back to that sort of marginalized core group of folks, I know in society tries to regulate how they act in public, how we act in public, you know. And to say, to try to harness things that are natural, or to try to restrict things that come naturally, is unhealthy and inhumane,
right,
in my opinion. So when we talk about things like kill the flesh, okay, sure, Paul is Paul. I mean, you know, he's a guy, has his opinions about the text, has his opinions about Jesus and his own body and all the things, you know. But I think if we're going to try to put a spin on Paul, I think Paul is trying to say, like, don't do anything that prevents you from loving other people well.
Yes.
You know, if it's going to prevent you from loving others, loving yourself, well, I don't know if Paul was very good at loving his own self.
Yeah. Very true.
Because he's very hard on himself, and he's very hard, you know. So, but that's something to analyze again in another podcast, maybe.
Yeah.
But anything that prevents you from loving others and loving self, to me, would be, you know, maybe going down that direction of, like, you know, you got to kind of watch what you're doing, right? But yeah, Paul is an interesting character to talk about in the text that I don't necessarily agree with all the time.
Right.
To be quite honest.
I mean, I would definitely agree as well. You know, when I hear someone calling him Paul, it automatically gives me pause, honestly.
The hairs go up on my arm. I'm just like, oh no, it's Paul again. Okay.
The hairs go up, the eyes get bigger, like,
yes, Greg. You know,
it's just one of those things, because, you know, for in a lot of my circles of friends who are Christian, the tendency is to quote Paul over Jesus.
Oh, yes. You know,
Paul is the go-to for anything, for sexual ethic, for whatever. Paul is the go-to. Why can't we, what Jesus says in the Gospels, for those exact same things? And why can't that be how we govern our lives?
I agree with you. And if we want to get down to some basic facts about the text, it's actually Luke who has more writing in the New Testament than Paul. And we don't talk about Luke very often, not as much as Paul. And then several of Paul's letters are disputed as being authentic. And yes, we have to take those into account too. So if we extract those letters that are disputed, and then we take into account that Luke is actually taking up more writing space than Paul, I think it gives us a lot of permission to be like, you know what, should we be really paying attention that much to Paul so much? Like, the church has given him so much authority, but right, I think we need to reevaluate that, like you were saying, for sure.
For sure. For sure. And I think the reason that the church has given Paul so much authority is, again, as a means of control, and taking what Paul wrote and using it to push their own agenda.
You're absolutely right. I totally agree with you.
Yeah. So, we love to hate Paul around here.
I'm not mad about it. I'm hard on Paul. I am hard on that guy. And I think we need to be harder on him. I'm sorry. But we, you know, that guy has caused a lot of trauma in my life.
Absolutely. So I wanted to ask you about a concept that you mentioned in one of the days in the devotionals. And is it Chokmah?
Oh, it's Chokmah.
Chokmah, okay. So this is a Hebrew word, correct? So like some letters are pronounced differently, I'm sure. Chokmah. So can you tell us what this is and how it correlates back to our feelings, again, in our personal life?
Chokmah is really cool. I learned about it in undergrad and in seminary, but anyway, it's wisdom. It means wisdom, but it's a specific kind of wisdom. It's not like, let's say I'm a surgeon and I go to school to become a surgeon, and all the biological knowledge that I glean or anatomical knowledge that I glean helps me become a better surgeon. It's not that kind of wisdom. It's the ability to read the room. So we can go back to that surgeon and all those years and years of studying and medical expertise that the surgeon has gleaned. But let's say that surgeon is in a moment of crisis with a patient and has to make a split decision. You know, I've got to do this based on my expertise, based on my knowledge, you know, whatever. I've got to read the room and make a decision right here and now. And it's going to affect the patient, of course. So Chokmah wisdom is just the ability to know, you know, what is going on in a given moment. Is it appropriate for me to do XYZ? Is it appropriate for me to be angry? You know, like that kind of thing. And we see the example of this kind of played out really well in the text with the character of Esther. Esther, I think, gives us the best example of using Chokmah wisdom. She uses everything. Her mental awareness, her experience with the king, her experience as a Jew, her experience as a marginalized person, all these things to make these really smart decisions in that given moment, at that given time. And it changed everything for the Jewish community when you get to the end of the story. But it's just this kind of ability to weigh and measure things rather than piling knowledge upon knowledge upon knowledgeable, you know, facts on facts on facts. Right. It's a different skill. So how that plays into our emotions is, again, the ability to use our emotions in an appropriate, measured way. Jesus flipping tables.
Yeah.
He was reading the room. And he was like, not on my watch.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
I think Jesus is a great example of reading the room all the time. So, I mean, I could pick tons of stories, but it's about using your feelings, your emotions, all of the experience, basically experiences that you've gleaned in your life, that you've learned in your life, to make a decision in a given moment at a given time.
Yeah. When I first saw that, I was like, wow, this is interesting, because, you know, I've been fascinated with the Hebrew Bible for several years now, and I really can't put into words the exact reasons why, but yeah. I just love that part of the Bible so much. So thank you for teaching us that. Why do you think that our stories are authoritative? And if you could kind of delve into what you believe is authoritative, because that word a lot of times is another word that's weaponized. Mm-hmm. So why is our story sharing in your mind, why is it authoritative? Because you spoke about your community giving your story authoritative value. And so what does that mean exactly?
Yeah, it's because my community gave me the space to share my story and to share it authentically without fear, without repercussions, and any of those things. That's why community is authoritative. Mm-hmm. Building communities and building coalitions creates authority that subverts power, that subverts systems of oppression. So the more we build communities, share our stories in communities, the more I feel like we're dismantling those pieces of power that stem from, in my opinion, white supremacy. Mm-hmm. It was the first time for me as a queer non-binary person where I could share about myself and about my life, and the people I was saying these things to loved me and accepted me no matter what, and they gave me a platform, they gave me a space to share it, and I gave them that in return. So I think the other thing that makes communities authoritative, or sharing stories in communities authoritative, is reciprocality.
Yes.
I think that's a big component, is that we reciprocate to one another, allowing one another to share. Those stories have power. Like we know this because, I mean, in the Bible is the perfect example of that. Stories have power. Look how long this thing has been around for.
Right.
Thousands and thousands and thousands of years. That's how powerful stories are. But what happens to marginalized communities is their stories get erased. Their stories get smashed down. Their stories get stifled and oppressed. Mm-hmm. So that is why when we especially expand ourselves and join other communities that are not like us. Mm-hmm. Like me having community with my Black friends, me having community with my Indigenous friends, things like that. Like we help each other share our stories in other communities. And again, I feel like that's how we gain trajectory and momentum.
Yeah.
By basically saying, like, not just, you know, we're building inclusive spaces, but, and I forget who said this, but they were talking about expansive spaces, instead of necessarily inclusion, but expanding out beyond ourselves.
Right.
You know, to reach out to others. And I really feel like the Bible is an interesting vessel to learn some of those things from, like from Jesus and from some of the other characters in the biblical text. But that's what I think authority in communities kind of comes from and is really powerful. And I'm learning more about it. I am definitely not an expert on that. It's something that I honestly sit at the feet of because when I learned about communal care, mm-hmm. I didn't learn about it from white people. I learned about it from Black people.
Yeah.
Learned about it from my BIPOC friends, not from my white friends. So I am sitting at the feet of those folks.
Yes.
Helping me understand that better so that I can action that out in my life as well.
I want to drop a quick nugget. I definitely agree with you about the whole communal care piece. And where I learned about it from, which is another reason why I celebrated Kwanzaa this past year, because Kwanzaa is all about being together and celebrating each other. It's all about that and helping each other. And it's the epitome of that. Like, each of the days of Kwanzaa can be tied back to community and how we show up for each other.
That's so cool.
Yes. And it was something that I hadn't done growing up as a child. You know, my family, we did Christmas and that was it. But, yeah. You know, the both holidays happened around the same time, but we just didn't do it. So right. You know, in my own journey, spiritual journey and faith journey, I just decided it was important for me to do that. And I'm glad that I did, because everything you just said, it correlates back to that practice of Kwanzaa. Revisiting the passage in Matthew that we talked about earlier, where Jesus is asked, what is the greatest commandment? When we think about the greatest commandment that Jesus mentions in that verse, why is that significant as it relates to affirming our emotions as valid and holy? And in that commandment, when he says love others, how does loving others help us move toward that place of realizing and affirming that our emotions are valid and they're holy?
Yes, because, well, that is good, excellent question that I don't know if I answered in my devotional, but it's something to think about, is something to process, right? That's a great question. I think that the it's an invitation, you know, love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as you love yourself. There's a lot of activity happening in that passage. So I think that the first thing that I noticed about the language in the passage is that everything starts internally, inside of our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
With all your strength, with all your heart, with your mind. That's starting from the inside. And then it by nature, by, you know, just what it's mentioning, it means that you have to have a kinetic action produced as a result of what's happening inside of your body. So whatever's going on there is, it's telling us to act on our emotions, on our feelings, and the things inside of us.
Okay.
But it's also showing us, giving us direction on how, like, what the proper ways of doing that are. Obviously, loving neighbor is something we should strive for, you know, things like that. So I think it's totally validating emotion and feeling, because it starts with what's happening internally inside of us, you know,
yeah.
And then telling us to use that emotion, to use that energy inside of us, and to push it out as action of love towards God. And that means that if we love God, then we love our neighbor. Mm. You know, we must act on our love. That's what it's saying. So to me, it validates our emotions, our feelings, but it's also telling us that you can't just sit with that.
Yeah.
You've got to move on it. You've got to act on it. You know, and demonstrate that onto other people in other communities, everywhere.
Right.
All of humanity. So, but that's a great question. And I'm going to process that more.
Yeah.
Think about that more, because I think it does validate our emotions and our feelings, because it's saying that it's, not only natural for us to use them, it's imperative that we use them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that actually ties into the next question, you know, which is about kind of, I guess I would say, a self-affirmation of sorts, which is about being able to fully be ourselves when it comes to expressing our emotions. And you even say that God gives us permission to do just that. Why do you think it's important for us to sit in that and know that?
Oh my gosh, I think God wants us to feel safe with God. Mm-hmm. Not just to feel safe with God, but to feel safe with ourselves. You know? And I think I think it's in Thessalonians, and I'm not sure if I put that in the devotional, but it says, test everything and hold fast to that which is good. We are allowed to test whether or not what God is telling us is true. And one of the ways we do that is by being our authentic selves.
Yeah.
And seeing if it's, okay, God, you know, is it going to be this sin management thing like these people are telling me? Or are you saying that I get to be myself and I get to live authentically into that? You know, we get to test that according to God, which I think is so cool. You know, I think that God wants us to feel peace in our bodies and safety, protection, all those things. And I feel like the only way we can do that is if we are ourselves with no shame. You know, that's why being queer, I think we are taught, or I was taught, that I should be ashamed of who I am as a person, yeah, to my core. And I hated myself. I had internalized homophobia for years and years and years. And I never felt at peace. I never felt at ease. I never felt any of those things that God said I would feel in the text, you know, even though I was being obedient. And then I realized God was giving me permission to just live into my life and to accept who I was. And then I started to feel that peace. Then I started to feel no shame. I started to feel like this was me living into the Imago Dei.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like you've found a place where you were liberated. And yeah. Jesus, I love the Gospels because of the way Jesus interacts with people. He says in John that you will know the truth and the truth will make you free.
Yes. So I love that verse too. Yeah.
You know, because it's like, when I think about that, if I'm to be my authentic self, and if that is the truth of who I am, then and only then can I be free. Mm. Because as I'm living into what someone else has, a box has been created for me. And yes, that's not the truth of who I am. And it doesn't even have to be about our personal identities. It could be about anything that is our truth, or that we as people acknowledge to be true about a thing. When we acknowledge that it is what it is, and we honor ourselves by living into that, that is when we become free.
Right.
And what emotions come from freedom? Joy, happiness, having a peace of mind.
Oh, yeah.
I think all of those things are things that God desires for us.
I agree with that. God, I think God wants us to flourish and thrive. All of us. So to restrict, like, try to put a restriction on someone's life or someone's identity, you know, will only prevent that flourishing and thriving from happening.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so with that, I want to say thank you again, Erin, for being here today.
Of course. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you so much. This has been very refreshing. This conversation has been very refreshing and eye-opening, and I've learned a lot from you. Can you please give us your socials and other ways we can support your ministry that you're a part of as well.
Yes, absolutely. So I am on Twitter at Erin Greenbean. That's the easiest way to find me. And then if you want to support the work that I'm involved in, protecting queer, trans, and non-binary students, you can follow us at REAP_LGBTQ on all the social platforms, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And then our website is www.thereap.org if you want to follow or donate to the cause or anything like that. Yeah. Those are the ways to find me. Those are the ways to get involved in the work.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Erin. And to our audience, I want to remind you all that decolonization does not happen overnight. Until next time, be blessed. Peace.